No, I'm interested. I'm interested in all this stuff. And you guys have, you were given this gift for a reason. You know, it wasn't like an like talk about obligations. It wasn't, oh God, it's their birthday. Let me give them a pet rock just so I can appear to give them something. No, you guys got gold. Let it shine, man. Spin that gold. You know, the widow's mite. You know, you were given gold. Invest it. Use it. Spread it out. Because, you know, think of the people's lives you can change with your stories, with your good stories, with your stories of like soul and heart and value.
What if story is the answer to our crises of meaning and belonging, to our impulse to heal our lives and help others, to our desire and drive to leave this world better than we found it? Now, we love good stories. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. Not just with the stories themselves, but with the stories behind the stories. Their oddly perfect timing, the healing process they provoke in their authors, and their capacity to catalyze individual and collective change. And we love exploring these with writers, thought leaders, entrepreneurs, healers, parents, and others. Tune in to hear these stories behind the stories and entertain with us the real possibility that whether you are a teller or a consumer, story is always offering or leading us to an answer. Roy Griff Griffiths dropped so deep into the conversation around the identity of a writer in our first interview that we had to run with it for the entire hour. It was so good. But then we had to ask him to come back and share what he's learned about the creative process in his more than four decades of writing short stories, novels, screenplays, and more. Tune in to hear Griff share what he's learned about his own unique needs as a writer and how that impacts his career. You'll hear him talk about the mindset and the writing practices that fuel and protect his writing process. And there's a great conversation in here about how structure and discipline work alongside inspiration and divine downloads. It's time. Get a cup of something delicious and enjoy these sips of story and sanity with us. All right, welcome to Sips of Story and Sanity, where we talk about the stories behind the stories with authors, speakers, writers, healers, parents, and more. I have my team with me because we always get the most delicious sips out of our guests when we work together. So we have my son, Aaron.
Hello.
My sister, Alyssa.
Hi.
And three clients turned friends turned team members. So we have Teddy.
Hey, y'all.
And Lori.
Hi, everyone.
And Carlin.
Hi, Carlin.
So today we have a returning guest, which is super fun. We got to speak with Roy Griff Griffiths a month ago. And was it a month ago? It feels like a few lifetimes ago. But anyways, we had this wonderful conversation and we all wanted it to continue. And then we had to figure out the schedule. So I'm excited to dive deeper into more of the creative process with you today, but I want to share a little bit with our new listeners and viewers about who you are. So Roy Griff Griffiths calls himself a storyteller for a lot of reasons. He decided to be a writer when he was 10 and never looked back. Along the way, he's done all the usual starving artist jobs, janitor, waiter, bookstore clerk, and a few unusual ones. He was the 62nd aviation rescue swimmer in the U.S. Coast Guard. He doesn't just write action adventure, he lived a little of it himself. He's written poetry, plays, and screenplays. He's also the author of 12 novels, including the epic historical fiction saga By the Hands of Men and the alternative history series, The Lonesome George Chronicles, as well as some of comic fantasy, and you have to tell me what it is.
Cthulhu amalgamate.
Cthulhu. Okay.
I'm having deja vu. That's the same exact thing that happened last podcast. I think it's the same line. You're going to have to help me.
I'm like, oh, shoot. I should have written it out last time. So in 2018, he received the John Millis Screenwriting Award for his original film script, Cold Day in Hell. Welcome back, Griff.
It's nice to be here with all you fine folks.
Yeah. And I'm excited today. Like I said, last time we got to hear about your story, which I loved every single moment of hearing about your story of, you know, being inspired when you were 10 and never looking back and all of the personal pieces around identity. I think that conversation is so important for writers and authors and messengers, because it is something that people hear me say often, that we're basically signing up for a constant identity crisis when we get into this process because of what we have to engage in ourselves and in the world while we're trying to get these messages out and these stories out. So today, I know at the end, Alyssa especially was just like, but I have so many questions, because Carlin and Alyssa have both been writing novels for the last few years. And so I'd like to hear from them as far as like, what are your big questions? Where do you find that you got the most stuck in your process, Griff? So is, when you think about the process, like there's the inspiration for the book, there's a process of writing it, there's character development. Like, is there a place in the creative process for you where you most often go sideways or get stuck for a little bit?
Well, I've recently learned about one, but I'll tell you about the first one that I observed in myself was trying to force it. You know, it's that weird paradox between having discipline and trying to force something that's not ready. There are definitely projects I've tried that weren't ready, but I tried to grind through them. And at a certain point, I just had to say, this is not working. And that's painful, as you guys know, because you're like, oh man, I just dumped 40,000 words, 150 or 60 pages on this thing that, I don't know, I just wasn't feeling for some reason. It may have been a good idea at one point in time, but maybe that's all it was. At least that was for me. But the other thing I recently learned is I'm not sure I work well under other people's deadlines. I had a three-book contract for this pretty cool idea, I thought, called Lone Star Witches. And I'll just give you guys the elevator pitch, which is there is a little town, this is true, I love those true things, in Texas called Salem, Texas. And I was driving by there on a rainy day, as it so happened, and I looked at this sign and I said to myself, why is there a Salem in Texas? And somebody in the car answered, obviously, the people in Salem 400 years ago got tired of getting their asses kicked, and they moved out to the middle of nowhere so that they could live in peace until this whole state and country grew up around them. So I said, okay. And that was sort of the start of the idea. The first book was called, I can't remember. But I've got it written down there on my bulletin board behind me. But it's kind of an interesting idea, just partly the idea of these people have been like sort of hiding out for 400 years, and what have they actually been doing? And then you start getting into all kinds of questions of what did they actually do? You know, were they in fact behind all the wickedness in Salem 400 years ago? Anyway, so I kind of, in my mind, I put together a story, and I know where it begins and I know where it ends. So I happened to mention it in passing to this publisher. I sent them like the first 10 pages and briefly outlined the story. And they said, hey, great. Here's a three-book contract. No money up front. And it was they're small press. So it was not retirement money by any chance. But what they did have were some sort of requirements because of they did a lot of paranormal romance and urban fantasies, and that's, you know, its own niche industry almost, and people have their expectations of what's going to be there. Part of that is the length of the book. You know, it needed to be between 60 and 80,000 words, and, you know, there were three books. And I'm writing along, and I'm, you know, I'm discovering stuff, and I'm, you know, creating cool characters and having fun with all that. But there's this thing in the back of my head about, I don't think, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to go 80,000, get to 80,000 words and have a good breaking place, for one thing. Because I think I mentioned in the last one, last time we talked, I discovered when I started writing novels, I can't shut up. You know, I mean, the characters show up and it's like, where the hell did you come from? And why are you, you know, becoming so important to my main character? That, again, that sort of thing was happening in this, but there was that concern of feeling those artificial limitations to the story that was sort of organically happening. And I was struggling with it because, you know, gosh, I'm getting, putting out 180,000, 220, you know, 240,000 words isn't that terrifying for me, and the story's going along, but it was just that, man, I didn't want to have to put restraints on myself and on the story based on these artificial limits. So it was a really becoming kind of a grind, because I'm 40,000 words into it, and I'm like, oh man, I gotta, you know, do I have to shortcut some stuff? And it would have felt less organic anyway. I didn't know that about myself, but it was actually the first time I've been writing a novel under contract or a series. But by my good, by, watch out for the cat, she's going to try to kill me. By good fortune, the place was sold. And I'd already told them, look, I'm going to be late on this thing. And part of it was, you know, my wife's knee surgery, which became just totally a nightmare for her. And a little bit for me. So I'd gotten off track time-wise, and they said, yeah, fine. Well, anyway, when they sold the company, they were pretty much telling people, you can buy back your contract and your covers for $500. So I said, I didn't turn anything in. I said, yeah, okay, you can get out of it. Sweet. So I just finished today. Today I wrote the very last page of the third Cthulhu Amalgamated novel, Break Room of a Thousand Nightmares, and you can see the couple of the covers on my bulletin board back. They're probably like this big. Mm-hmm. I wrote the very last page of that. So once I get it, started going through the put in the KDP and that sort of thing, I'll probably go back to this 40,000 word novel that I've got so far, because I still think it's a worthwhile story. But I just didn't know that I can't really have those kind of constraints. And that for me, it's got to come to a natural stopping point before I'll stop it. Because otherwise, it just felt forced. And my brain was like thinking, how can I shortcut this? How can I get around this? What can I do? And so that's what I learned. Sorry. So I know there's a question there somewhere.
No, it was great. That's what a wonderful way to learn a lesson, when you get to get out of it. Get to learn it and then easily get out of it.
I skated. Yeah.
Yes, because I've known people who are under other contracts, and they just had to kind of grind it out and have that lack of integrity feeling. It's like, I have a lack of integrity for not fulfilling, or I have a lack of integrity creatively, and that's rough. But yeah, that's
certainly would compromise your emotional investment at that point.
Yeah. So what does the process look like? Because if viewers don't know, Griff is the husband of one of my most favorite mentors, who actually got me on this crazy journey. And she's also an incredible writer. So I'm assuming that she's part of your process. Is that a correct assumption, as far as like thinking through ideas and giving you feedback on content?
It's a common misconception, actually.
Okay.
there, I'm sound so weird when I started mentioning this stuff. I'm really weird about my stories. I don't want anybody to know how it ends until they've read it.
Okay.
And so I don't tell Elisa, my wife, how it ends. I don't tell, I do have one publisher. I don't tell them how things are going to end. I just say, here it is. It's done now. And I'm actually pretty weirdly hesitant to mention anything to Elisa or anybody else while I'm writing it, other than maybe the, kind of an offhand chuckle. Hey, I did something really, really cool today. But I'm weird. I just want people, I don't care who you are. I don't care if I'm paying you to read it. I want, my editors and publishers and whoever to actually come to it and be surprised or amazed or whatever it is they're going to be. But, I don't talk about, hardly any of that stuff. Now, when I was younger, I discovered, again, here's one for you youths, that's you, talking about a story, you could talk that damn thing to death. Mm. Got this cool idea, I'm going to tell somebody, and you're talking about it, or I was talking about it, and I'm working stuff out, and then it's all gone.
Mm.
And it didn't have the same power for me when I went back, so I kind of learned to shut up. Now, when I was doing screenplays, I had to kind of go through, I had to, because I was working with managers, my manager and stuff, I did have to let them in a little bit, but, even then I was only off as much as I could. I was like, okay, here's some pages. Oh, this is great. Cool. Just wait till you see the next stuff. But yeah, definitely, I just can't talk about them because it kind of kills it.
That's so interesting.
Well, it's almost like letting a little pressure out of the old Instapot there, and it doesn't cook as well or something.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, I'm surprised by the fact that that happens for as long, but I do know that that's one of the things that I often recommend to new writers is like, don't talk about it so much, mostly for the sake of if you haven't articulated it well enough yourself, it's kind of like, you wouldn't know this, but it's kind of like being pregnant. Like, you just don't talk about it at first because you don't know how it's going to end up, right? Like, you're assuming it's going to become a baby, but you're not sure. And there's all the things that you want to make sure. Maybe you just tell a few people who are trusted, who will be in your corner, but like, don't tell everybody, because then you got to hear all their advice and all of their criticism about parenting and all that. It's just like, you get the kitchen fridge of advice before you even know what you're really doing and have that connection to the content yourself. So that's interesting.
That's not even to mention the accountability factor when you start talking to people about it.
Yeah. You don't want to be on the hook for something you're not necessarily going to create or carry out.
Right.
So you still want the option to abandon the child, basically, is what you're saying.
I like chicken exits. I'm very careful about who I tell what to, because I like making chicken exits for myself. It's actually really funny listening to you talk about sort of writing within restraints, because we had a workshop this week that was just a super fun experience and kind of painful. But I, like, growing up, I never considered myself as a creative. I hated all the projects in school where we were asked to draw or to paint or, like, just give me structure. I know the structure for an essay. Give me a prompt. I'll write you, like, a 10-page paper as long as I don't have to draw anything or get creative, And I always swore I'd never build a career off any sort of creative anything. So then I've been working on this book series, but it has a very particular structure, and it's the only type of fiction I've ever foreseen myself writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm committed to that. I've told tons of people we're going in that direction now. So we did this 2-hour workshop on Monday, and Amanda gave, I can't even remember what the first hour, it was a bunch of really deep, great stuff, but I can't even remember it because the next part when she had us do this like free write exercise terrified all of the knowledge out of me and I forgot everything. But she gave us three objects. It was like a monkey, a sword, and a jester, right? From, yeah. And she said, write a 10 minutes, write any story about these three things. And I like started bleeding inside at, I get hurt for a good long time trying to, you know, and I was like melting down, trying to get creative. And anyway, ended up doing it. And it was like this massive breakthrough experience for me. And I was able, I don't know what happened, but it was like breaking out of my own creative, my own restraints and my own framework mm-hmm. that I've put around my own creativity. You know, like I only write poetry when I'm feeling or doing or expressing or this, this, and this. I only write fiction when I'm working on this specific novel series. But this was like terrifying meltdown. I pushed through it, and then afterwards it was like freedom. It was like I just created this two paragraph little story and I played with words in all these fun ways, and it felt like it took me to this magical little land. And you know, I worked through some deeper stuff because some other stuff came up in that story that I was like, oh, this is indicative of some therapy that needs to happen. But that was that, just when you were talking about restraints other people putting on you, I'm so terrified of that, that it's like I put restraints around my creativity before other people can for me.
Well, it sounds like you found your next novel series. Actually, that's a great prompt. I was thinking myself, I can't do with that. I think what you're touching on and what can just, which took me as you guys, everybody I think here except maybe Carolyn, I don't see her anymore, heard was having to sort of free myself of those limitations, or as I said at the time, the lies I would tell myself about myself, you know, and kicking those out of the way helped a lot. And the other thing that has really helped me a lot, and it could be because of my advanced age, was anymore, I'm just saying to myself, what can I lose? You know, I mean, it's not going to put me in jail. I mean, geez. You know, it's been phrased a lot of ways. You know, it's don't let perfect be the enemy of good, which I think is very useful. But I heard it best in the Coast Guard, which they told me rather bluntly, you got to be afraid. You can't be afraid to step on your dick. You know, I mean, let's talk about put your ego away. Boy, I just, man, please.
You just got the title for this episode.
It's all yours. But I mean, you know, I used to like go to myself with the cleats there. And yeah, you know, that fear of what happens if I fail? Well, it's not like I haven't failed a time or two already. And, you know, sort of like what happened with you, Alyssa, is you might find out something there. So I've really started embracing that a lot, is what can I lose? And that's actually sort of how I entered into the, it's a contract with guys who do paranormal romances. And if y'all know anything about that, it's got its whole, you know, tropes, and it's really got wikis and fan clubs, and, you know, the covers all look the same. And I was actually answering somebody else in another interview about what I write. And you know, I said, I can't write the same thing over and over again, because I can't be the guy who is the shape shifting harem novel series guy, you know, but there are people who write 20, 30 books about the, you know, the wolf shapers and the, you know, the sloth shapers and whatever it is. But I don't know if I could do that. But I told these guys what I was going to do, what I wanted to do with this, and it would not have fit into any particular niche. I thought, why not? And it's the same thing with writing the book anyway, because I think it's kind of a cool story, and maybe sort of like you and the monkey and the axe and the, you know, Lizzie Borden, you know, the monkey Lizzie Borden or whatever it was. You know, you found out first you can do it, to your great surprise, And all of a sudden it's like, wow, I got this, I have a new tool in my toolbox that maybe I can use later. So
that I definitely need to do with other people, because there's no way in hell I would sit down and do that to myself for 10 minutes. But if I have like a meeting set and we got a workshop set, you know, so we were trying to figure out how we could work it into our community time to, because it was a great exercise, but I wouldn't put myself through that.
Okay, yeah. Well, but look what you learned, even though it was no fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it makes me wonder too, Griff, with you, because I know you have so much discipline around the time that you set aside. Like it's this basically the same time every morning, right? For the same amount of time. And I'm curious about that, because there is that piece for me, like when I'm facilitating workshops, not necessarily writing workshops, but just helping people get to the bottom of things really quickly, I found that that real serious constriction around time actually gets us clearer faster, right? It's kind of the same thing that happens when you ask someone, if you only had 30 days left, what would you do? All of a sudden, the 500 things on the bucket list turn into 3, right? Like, and it comes pretty clear. So I found that over and over with the time crunch, and I always have the disclaimer of like, you'll love me and you'll hate me as you go through this, because that's what it does. It puts some sort of confine, some sort of constriction on there that really hurts at first, until you realize like, ooh, there's something. So do you find that with your time? Like if you stick to that rather than go with bigger blocks of hours, do you get more done or?
A little. I think for me, a lot of the benefit is that it actually, first, it is a discipline, almost in a spiritual sense, like you try to pray or meditate every day. And that's sort of like telling one part of your brain, I'm serious about this. Mm-hmm. I think the other part of it is, I remember reading a guy who's from the 40s, I think, and he said, he's talking about work, you know, productivity and things like that. And he said, work expands to fill the amount of time allotted for it. So, you know, my brain says, hey, I got all day. Well, you're right. I've got cat time, and you know, maybe I'll go for a bike ride. No, but if I've got that 2 hours, so the limitation is, yeah, that's my time. But the flip side is it's freeing in the sense of, by knowing it's 2 hours, it isn't like my brain is going, come on, man, you can get 20 pages. No, it's 2 hours. So I'm not going to necessarily make myself nuts. On the other hand, on Saturday and Sunday mornings, if nothing's going on, I get up early, I'll start working. Yeah, I'll work 4 or 5, 6 hours. Mm-hmm. But that's recognizing I do have that free time. You know, that this is my Saturday and that's what I want to do. But the 2 hours also, I think, kind of frees my brain to, it takes a little of, you know, it's like taking that gun away from my head, actually the clock shaped gun, and just saying 2 hours, that's a cup of coffee, maybe two, and just sitting there, you just pound it out, and it can be steady. But at the same time, you don't have sort of that, I don't have that pressure of, well, you've got enough time to finish this chapter and start the next one or whatever it is. It's by having 2 hours, it's almost like a dip back into the existing time stream of the novel that's going on. But I just take a small chunk of it, and it's manageable. But at the same time, I feel like I feel good about the discipline, and I feel good about the productivity. May not be a lot of pages, and some mornings it's not. Other mornings, you know, it's 5 or 6 pages. That piles up, you know. You do that consistently, that piles up.
Yeah. Do you have a least favorite phase of the whole process, of the entire, you know, inspiration to publishing and beyond?
Well, marketing, you know, makes me pretty much want to kill myself because it's not that much fun. I mean, it's much more fun to write the book, And, you know, and marketing in a way feels a lot like looking for a job. Used to, you know, you got the resume in your hand and you're trying to convince people you're cool. You're like, come on, I shouldn't have to, damn it. But that's kind of a drag. Some of the physical structural parts of the publishing would get a little annoying, but I've gotten over those with just some experience, you know, actually taking the, I'm so old school, you know, my stuff on Word looks basically 8.5 by 11, like the old paper I grew up typing on. And then you take that and you've got to reformat it to your paperback size, and then you've got to copy edit it. And we all know Word has these weird things, like the person who came up with the paging process in Word really needs to be dragged through town, out through the tumbleweed. That stuff used to be a real pain, but I've gotten sort of figured it out. So that's less of a pain, and it is time consuming, but yeah, I'd say it's the part that, and I realized I gotta change my paradigm on it, but yeah, trying to make people aware that the book's out there. Although I've gotten a little better about that too. I've been able to find some people who like the stuff, and I can say, you know, can you take a look at it? Because on some of these pages, it's good to have not just, this is my grandmother, you know, reviewing me, but, and she's dead. So that's a really impressive.
Yeah, that would be really bad.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Different book entirely. But, you know, there are some magazines I found and some people who really like my stuff. And so when I get another book, I can reach back out to them and say, hey, I got this next one. Will you take a look at it? And usually they say yes. So that helps. But, you know, still there's the whole marketing stuff and making sure people know that this staggering work of heartbreaking genius is just waiting for people to discover and, you know, have their lives changed by it.
Okay, so I have to ask, because that's like voicing another sort of stage of the process where your identity is challenged again in a whole new sense. And we talked a lot about that in the last episode, all your years of trying different identities and kind of always coming back to this writer one and being weary of like fully stepping into it, right? And so Carlin gave me the book Bird by Bird, and like every one in my life has been repeating it to me. So I started reading it. And are you familiar with that book at all? Yeah.
I read it years ago. Yeah.
Well, actually, as you're talking, all the satire and the way that you talk is reminding me of her, because I don't think I've ever read a book out loud and laughed as hard as I have with her. Because some of the things I'm like, oh my God, she's articulating everything, you know, like I'm just sitting down to just bang out a page or, you know, a few pages or get this scene out. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand how that like small thing will turn it unravel into an entire identity crisis every single time, because I get like half of nothing that isn't valuable at all onto a page. And then all of a sudden I'm like, what the hell am I doing with my life? So I'm really curious, after all your years of doing this, if that still happens to you, or if you got like, you put all of those, what does she say? You put all those like genies in the lamp and you put them, or you, the rats in a bottle, not genies in the lamp. Too magical.
I think I'm past that, which again was part of that, you know, let go of the ego, let go of the idea that my value as a human being is based on whether anybody reads the book or not. That was freeing. And these days, I also, I think when I realized I wrote for free for decades. So what does it matter if I'm writing for free right now? Mm-hmm. It keeps me off the street, out of the bars, and all that other stuff. So, and you know what, if I can make myself laugh, or if nothing else, I'm telling a story I'd like to read. And I don't get it as much, although I understand that frustration, but golly, you know what you did with the Lizzie Borden monkey, I'm telling you, you know, if there's a way you can find to just release yourself from that, sort of that expectation, you know, that it's gotta be great, how about it's gotta be, you know, and I would encourage you, just plow through it, man. Just give yourself permission to just write it and go with it. And if it, and, you know, when you talk about having that structure, which is great, because, you know, I sort of have mine that you guys have heard about. I get the beginning, the end, and I start at the beginning and I fight my way to the end. I'm just wondering, I'm just wondering if that structure is strangling you just a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's absolutely strangling. And, you know, as you, a lot of what Anne Lamott talks about is how, you know, all her students are like, but publishing this and but agent this, and they're all so concerned with becoming a writer that they forget about writing. Mm-hmm. And all of the, you know, and a lot of what we do in our community is like writing to heal things. And I think writing obviously includes a lot of that for me, writing to heal, but writing to kind of free myself. But some of the sweetest moments I've found is in this first book that I've completed, going back through and rereading it. Mm-hmm. Is like really freeing, because I'm over here caught up in all my like awful self-talk or beliefs about it. And then I go through and I'm like, oh, this isn't that bad. Or I did put golden nuggets in here. My mirrors and my juxtapositions aren't, you know, so it's kind of like this freeing experience going back and rereading those things. So then it becomes a question of, yeah, it's like, even if no one else ever reads the book ever, it was freeing for myself to a certain point, you know, to just write it.
Okay. By the way, anybody jump in here. I'm just, you know, geez, I have a captive audience. I'm going to go for it, but please speak. I want to, and Amanda is going to like hit the mute button here if you have to. I this came to me while you were talking, I want to challenge you, Alyssa. I want to challenge you. For the next 2 weeks to write, to just write, forget the structure, forget, you know, just abandon expectation, be willing to step on your metaphor, you know, dick, just write it, because, you know, there's safety and structure, no doubt, but I just get this, I don't know if anybody else has this, but I kind of got this sense of, you know, you're sort of pushing against it. Mm-hmm. And that just came to me, you know, it's just, and I would really, you know, I'm not going to say I'll put money on it, but I would really encourage you to just set it aside just for 2 weeks, you know, write the story about the Lizzie Borden monkey, whatever it is, because I think it's there, but you may have set up some shoots that maybe were useful for your first book. But it just sounds like whatever you're writing now, give her the expectation. You know, let the books, let you surprise yourself in what you write. Just like you did when you reread. You went, damn, I'm smarter than I knew, you know? And I think Lori or Teddy, one of y'all said that last week, that stuff, you know, you see that stuff happening. And I think, Alyssa, that is just waiting to come out of you. But, you know, open up the chutes, man. Let the bulls run and see what happens.
Yeah, well, you done said it publicly now, so it's going to happen.
I threw down the gauntlet. I called you out.
I'm working it into my ideal calendar right now. I'm going to add it into the morning space.
Yeah, next thing you know, I'm mad dogging you about it. But yeah. I had another idea, but it's gone. So, you know, it's probably
pop over. It'll come back. It'll come back.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Did I go off into a rant? I do that sometimes.
No, like, if I could chime in, this is, it's really helpful, because when I get into talking about an idea, and usually this is like usually with Amanda, sometimes with Alyssa, where I mean, it'll get really expansive. And mm-hmm. there's been like in the beginning when I was downloading all these ideas, I kept telling my husband, I'm like, I feel a tiny bit crazy right now, because it's just coming in and I'm shooting it out on the page and it's out there. But then I sit down and I write and I get stuck on the right word. And I think this sentence has too many like words in it. And I was really trying to keep this chapter to 2000 words and it's 2250 and maybe I should go back and cut something out. And I same, right? As I narrow it all in there trying, I mean, I'll like live in the thesaurus for like an hour trying to find this like one word that's going to capture the thing I'm thinking about. When I know if I'm not doing that and I'm just running, it all shows up. Mm-hmm. Versus like just, you know, vomit it all out there and then go and clean it up a little bit later versus trying to make it so nice and neat in the beginning. Right, and I definitely get stuck in those like self-imposed constraints around like, you know, how is somebody going to read this? Are they going to get what I'm trying to say? Is this going to sound weird? Versus just letting it go.
And that's right. In your research rabbit hole.
Yeah, I love research. That's like one of my favorite things ever.
Oh yeah.
Do that, yeah. And then I'm not writing, of course.
But. There's a bunch of my research back there. Yeah. That was several books ago. I would I've done that. I understand. That's why it took me about 6 years to do my historical fiction series because I would stop. This is even the first draft, and then go look that thing up.
Yeah.
Right, and get the research rabbit hole, which can be useful because you just sort of pick up odds and ends. And I ended up picking up, you know, journals of a English, a group of English Bolsheviks in 1917 who went to Russia to, you know, support the People's Congress. And so I actually went, God bless Amazon, because people are reprinting all the public domain stuff now just to make a few bucks. Somebody reprinted this. So I grabbed it and that took me somewhere else. So it's cool and it's useful, particularly for that kind of stuff. But I've really gotten away from it in these last books that I've written. And I told these folks last time, like one of the things I'm doing in, this isn't a good example, but in my Cthulhu Amalgamated stuff, which is fantasy and it's based on the H.P. Lovecraft stuff. So you kind of want to do the occasional callback to it to keep people in the world. But I would just end up, and maybe this will work for you, but like that thing, whatever it is, that nugget, I would just put two asterisks and I might put in bold, name of his, you know, slimy Lovecraftian creature, asterisk, boom. And I just would keep going because it wasn't as important as the fact that the slimy thing was going to eat the hero. You know, who the slimy thing was, not as important as what was going to. So what I heard kind of was that you feel a little safer doing this stuff because, you know, probably you and Alyssa, well, I won't charge for this session, but like, you know, for you guys, the shoots and stuff are giving you a little safety because maybe the stuff you're writing, and actually I would love to look at anybody's stuff who wants to share it, just out of curiosity. But I think the shoots and that perfectionism gives you a little safety because, oh gosh, maybe first off, it's not perfect. You know, people are going to, oh, like you said, the vomiting thing, get it totally. You know, you plug into the Jungian dream time and it just goes, right? But that is scary stuff because you might be revealing more of yourself than you really want to. But I would encourage you guys, it's your first draft. You don't have to show it to anybody, not even Amanda. Sorry, Amanda, but you know, but gosh, remove those speed bumps and those roadblocks and just let that raving madman woman person inside you go. Because that, you know, again, in the Jungian stuff, that's where some of the wisdom is, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the gifts, you know, now we get the tarot cards, you know. But whoever it is shows up with the gifts, they don't always look like Santa Claus. You know, yeah. They look like a bag lady who needs a shower or something. But man, get rid of that those restrictions you're putting on yourself and let it fly. Yeah. And, you know, and first, I think a lot of creativity is like fusion, and you know, just it can feed on itself. It isn't like a destructive thing. I've found creativity begets more creativity. Mm-hmm. you know, my Lone Star Witches is now bleeding over into an entirely separate series, which isn't exactly paranormal, but just because I kind of got an idea and I ran with it. So, you know, you guys are like, you know, you're straining the fusion, man. Just pull the rods out. Let it go critical mass and see where it goes. That's just me.
Yeah. I think it's amazing. I mean, I know what that feel like. It's a feeling. Like, I don't know if other people have had that, like, where when I'm in it, like, it's like it's union, right? You've tapped into the stream of mm-hmm. this like collective unconscious that exists, and it just is firing. I'm grabbing this idea, and oh my God, this guy, and then it's like, you know, somehow it, you know, you put it in this little box, and all of a sudden it doesn't feel as fun.
True. Right. But yeah, I'm sure it's happened to Teddy and Lori as well, you know, because I want to hear y'all heard me last time. I want to hear what Lori's, you know, what happens when the dream time lands on her. Lori's muted.
What happens when the dream time lands on me? You know, I was thinking back to when you said that don't tell too many people, mm-hmm. because I feel like that is what, where I'm stuck right now. I've told too many people about what I think my next project is, mm-hmm. and then life happened, you know, and so it hasn't come to fruition. And so I'm finding myself having to really make time to even sit down and write. Like, all right, I'm going to have to, this is a future. It hasn't happened the last several months. So it's going to have to happen. Because I have all these ideas, like Carmen, just like spinning around my head, and I keep making these little mini notes on mm-hmm. what's going on. One of the questions I had for you is, it sounds like sometimes you're working on more than one book at a time. So is that a true statement, or is that just you have an idea from one that shoots you off to another and you finish the one project first?
Well, it has been in the past. Just this last year, I pretty much was working on the Cthulhu Amalgamated stuff. Although people want book 7 very badly of my historical fiction series, and that's sort of in the back of my head, along with what's the other one called? It's called Killer's Club. That's the one that's sort of a parallel to that. I could work on any number of things. So I'm probably going to go back to Lone Star, which is, here's a process thing for you. Since I got 40,000 words in, I knock out another 20,000, 25,000. I'll have a book. And so rather than losing all that work, I'll put in a little more work and clean it up, and I'll throw it out there in the world and see if anybody likes it. You know, if people don't respond, that's fine. I'm not sure I love it enough to just make myself go, go finish the last two books. But on the other hand, if people want it, then I'll do it. So I've got that. And if I don't, I've got Killer's Club. I've got a standalone paranormal story set in 1969. I've got a play I want to write about the making Casablanca. So I have all kinds of stuff, and it's almost more, it's going to be the two competing energies are going to be, it did something really set me on fire. Cthulhu Amalgamated did, just because it was so different, and it was so much fun for me because I was writing a really hapless character. This thing, who was not as smart as he thought he was, but very good-hearted. So I got to do a lot of picaresque things with him, and it was also very funny, and I made myself laugh a lot. But like I said, people are asking for By the Hands of Men book 7. I may do that next, because in one way, I feel like I owe it to the people who've read the book and are so kind. But it's also, it's still there, and I'm still excited by the characters, but I don't know. And my Lonesome George series is being republished sometime, probably toward the end of the summer. And that's a 3-book series. So people like it well enough. You know, I can do a 4th book in that. So I'm not currently doing 2 at 1 time, but I have in the past, you know, when I was working on By the Hands of Men and Lonesome George, fortunately they were like so different. There wasn't a lot of creative overlap. So sorry.
Yeah, mine are competing. It's like an adult book and couple children's books. And so mm-hmm. it's competing for my, which one do I feel most called to write at this particular time? And I really thought it was the children's book. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, last little bit, I'm kind of questioning myself on that. So we'll see. I don't know, because I am published, but I'm not, don't have the accolades that you have. And so I don't have anybody saying, come on, I need the 7th book, you know? So mm-hmm. there's that piece too, that,
right.
You know, sometimes you have to just make yourself sit down and do it and be consistent with it and put it out there and see, like you said, see what sticks.
Right. But I would really encourage you, man, find that time, you know, and reframe it when you're saying you have to. You get to.
Dang it, he caught me, didn't he?
It's not like I haven't said it, but yeah. But for me, what really made it happen was just having that time and just kind of sticking to it. Because again, it is really, I don't know, it's telling yourself, the universe, karma, that you're serious, that you're not screwing around. Because, you know, we've all seen in our life, talk is cheap. How many of you guys know people who said, gosh, I'd like to write a book someday? But yep. You guys have, you know, I mean, you did something different and you're, you know, you've already taken that additional step to, which to me, I think is really cool, because you've, it's almost like honoring a commitment to yourself, to your soul. And I gotta be honest, I'm really glad I did it, because I'm going back to my high school reunion in September, and there are people, the ones that are alive, I'm going to see, who just never pursued their dreams. And I don't know how I would be going on if I'd given up what I wanted to, you know, I said I wanted to do when I was 10. You know, it's like how empty that would be. But on the other hand, you guys, really, you stood before the gods, basically, and declared by your actions that this was important to you. And I think, again, there's the fusion energy in that, is that that makes it easier to do it the next time. And for me, as I said last time, once I got rid of that, you know, who am I writing for? You know, am I writing for, you know, what was it? You know, my goal to be a Hollywood screenwriter was to have starlets rubbing coconut oil on my bald spot, right? Well, get rid of that and realize, you know, that wasn't what I was thinking when I was 10 or 12. I was just like, this is really cool. I'm going to, and so when I decided I was going to write for myself, ultimately, first, and then I guess the God second, it was a lot more freeing. And then I just did it. But each time I do it, it's like working out. You know, really hard, you know, to start from that zero inertia point and to get uncomfortable and be, oh man, God, I don't want to be up at 4:30 in the morning. The cat's annoying me. Everybody's asleep. The bed was whatever it was. But the more you do it, the more I did it, the easier it got and the more rewarding it got.
Well, thank you for the workout. Analogy, because that works for me. So
our crack of dawn runner over here. before the crack of dawn runner.
4 a.m. on the track, you know.
Well, I'm actually trying to add a workout after my writing, which is why I've got the reins and stuff in the back here. And it's doing the same thing, a little bit at a time. You know, I it's so embarrassing how weak I was. And still am, but I'm not as weak as I was. because I've done a little bit at a time. And, you know, it's not glorious, and it's not going on my Facebook or Instagram, but I've seen progress because, you know, I kept doing it. And I was about to bust out the inch by inch, it's everything's a cinch, or, you know, whatever other cliche I could come up with.
Well, thank you, Lori, for inspiring me. I will.
Okay.
So, Griff, I am really curious because I know that there are some other people here who have different types of like starting methods. And so I'm super curious about your, if you have an like outlining process and your researching process. Because like Aaron's been working on a novel series in his back, you know, in the background, but to my knowledge, he's been outlining for this thing for like years and plans to outline it again, keep outlining it for years before he starts writing. And I felt like I did a basic structure outline, but I had to write to figure out what the rest of the story was going to be. And then I know Carlin will like hit a point, research rabbit hole, and then keep going research rabbit hole. So I was super curious how you do your research, how you integrate it, if you do any outlining for those things. Or do you just dive in?
You know, in my case, it depends on the, I guess, the work itself. Let's see, for Lone Star Witches, I've got these. I got these for book one. You know, I went through and... you know, I was making a lot of notes, and but again, this is for instance talking about the 1670s, whatever it was, 1614 in Salem. So I wasn't trying not to write a treatise, but more what I did was I knew sort of the story in terms of the characters start in Salem, and that's where the story starts. So I wanted to have details that would make it feel authentic. But a lot of it was more like I just read something interesting and maybe just get a basic sense of the geography, whatever. But I wasn't writing a lot. It was more like, what is this? I don't know. There you go. Lita leads this crying against. You know, Lita's the character. And oh, here we are. John Indian was a witch helping railroad innocents. Well, John Indian was Tituba's common law husband. And so I just made a note, oh, he could be part of this. So a lot of this was getting facts and just seeing where they could fit into the story, if they could. Not all of them will. I'm not going to use all of this. And then now for book two, it takes place in East Texas, maybe between the Alamo and, you know, the invention of the automobile. So I've got some books about the Texas Rangers, about being a, you know, a saddle tramp in Texas or growing up in East Texas. Again, more just for, to lend it sort of a structure of reality so that it's not the same old crap. But really, that's only to support the story of what these people are going through and kind of what they're experiencing. So, but for Cthulhu Incorporated, I didn't do that much research. I printed up a couple of wiki pages about the current Lovecraftian monsters, and I kept it off to one side. But at a certain point, I realized they made this crap up anyway. So now I'm just, you know, I would have fun coming up with...
origin story, your own mythology around it.
Well, no, they all had these weird names, like, you know, unpronounceable consonants and stuff about that long. And then they would explain it, also known as, you know, the AKA, let's see, the lurker in the galactic night. Okay. But I started reading a couple of those and, wow, I can make up my own. So, like, there was the mailman of Kismet, you know, who are presented as some terrifying beings of some kind that people should be afraid of, along with the, you know, the doom dogs of wherever. So yeah, at a certain point I started making it up, and the history was really reasonably contemporary. So in book one, I did a little reading about early atomic research physics. Book two was set in Texas, little town in East Texas, in Southern Texas, in the late 30s, no, early 40s, it turns out. So I did a little reading about that, but not a lot. I didn't have to do a whole lot. And that's, yeah, third, same deal. You know, it's a little bit of research, just again to get that supporting structure to make it feel consistent and sort of holistic without being too weird. Well, actually, wait a minute. It's going to be weird. But yeah, the third book, it features other stuff, but not a lot. It just really depends on what I'm writing. Now, when I go back to By Hands of Men, book seven, it's set in Hearst Castle in 1938-39. I've got a biography of William H. Hearst and Marilyn Davies, her memoir. I will pick up some books. Got across this great book by the WPA about Los Angeles in the 1930s Los Angeles. Yep. You young kids don't know about the WPA, but it was a Roosevelt program to put people to work, including artists. You know, John Steinbeck got hired to maybe go write travel guides. And so this WPA reprint is giving you stuff. It talked about what they call the black and white taxis. Those for the colored part of town. They only went to, you know, that part of town. And they gave names to these things. Anyway, that's the sort of thing that for a book like By the Hands of Men, I'll need. So I will probably end up reading a lot of those. Again, I know where the story ends, begins and ends in my mind. So I'll read these and it'll be more like taking a note going, that'd be cool. Mm-hmm. That'd be cool to put in a story. Or, wait, I didn't know that. And example from book five, cannibalism was a big deal, was still a problem in Africa at the turn of the century. And, a British mailman got eaten by cannibals in the 20s. And there were still cannibal tribes in there. I went, I didn't know that. So that became an interesting element, which, you know, you can work a whole bunch of other stuff into about my character having to confront this and, you know, and what it meant about evil and what it meant about, how we treat other people and put it in this whole place. But that was just something I ran across. It wasn't planned, but it was useful. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, but it's also useful for the story itself.
Mm-hmm. So it's more like getting a bunch of, it's like throwing a whole bunch of potential ingredients into the pot so that once you get into the process of writing, your mind has those there to pull on, like, oh, there was that detail.
Exactly. Or like I said, you're reading it going, wait, if I put this in the story, that would mean that the character could do this. So it's more like it's finding pieces of the puzzle I didn't know existed, you know, and these are the blank spots, and they're a great way to put the puzzle together. Hollywood, some guy in Hollywood in the 30s, depression, he went out to Wyoming and hired an entire troop of, I think it was Cheyenne, horses, teepees, everything, brought them back to the movies. So first, that's just kind of a cool thing that I didn't know had happened. But again, same thing. It could be used for some of my characters and what they were doing. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. It did. And then, so do you find yourself kind of going through, my process is pretty similar, actually. It's like I do just enough research to get enough inspiration to keep like the creative flow going, because mm-hmm. my series each book is based in a different culture. So I'm looking for mythology and origin stories that I can create the story off of in that culture.
Sure.
But what I did with the first book was I had, there was an experience in Costa Rica that sparked the inspiration for the whole thing. Wrote the book, did 4 years worth of rewrites and revisions, and then I went back to Costa Rica to get the actual research and to build the world, you know, like, because there was a certain draft where I was like, if anyone read this, they'd be like, this girl has never been to Costa Rica. She doesn't have any flowers, any plants. This place is hot for biodiversity, like largest biodiversity in the world, you know? And so I had to go back and get all that and actually put it in.
Well, most of it.
Most of it, yeah. So it sounds like your process is kind of similar. So do you go back at the end to refine the world building to make sure that it's like accurate for the historical time you're talking about and everything?
No, again, because the historical fiction, I kind of did as I went along. I mean, I did it first and then sort of like Caitlin was, am I saying anymore? Carlin? I'm sorry. Carlin, you're saying about getting stuck on that, you know, wanting to find that perfect thing. I've been trying to get away from that, but I definitely do it on the way back. And, I even, you know, I made notes. This was draft three, you know, these notes, right. And there's places here which are saying things like, check where the adrenal glands are, because I'd written it down and I just wanted to make sure it was right. But again, this is my final draft. You know, at the time I maybe did a quick Google search and I punched it in, but during the final draft, I said, yeah, I'm gonna check that. So I don't look like an idiot, or at least my character doesn't. So yeah, but I think for what you're doing, yeah, I could see definitely wanting that to be internally consistent and accurate to a degree. You know, I had to do that with By Hands of Men, was I had to remind myself, I didn't have to be that accurate. It didn't have to be completely and perfectly accurate. What it had to be was, I think, more emotionally true. Mm. And as long as we avoid the anachronisms in factual things, mm-hmm. and cultural and sociological anachronisms, you know, there were, you know, liberated women, but I'm not sure there were that many of them, as many as we see on Netflix, for instance, you know, in the 30s, standing up to the man. There were probably a lot more quiet and small acts, but there really weren't that many, I don't think. But, you know, I mean, what was it recently? Anne Boleyn, she was not Black, you know? It's a whole different sort of cultural thing, but that's the kind of stuff I try to avoid, but that's just me. And for the kind of story Alyssa's writing, that may not be important. But like I said, what I think is more important for the reader is to make sure that it's coherent, you know.
Enough.
Within the world you set up. Uh-huh. If you set up the world in a certain way, it's cheating to go outside of that. In television or movies, I call it dramatically convenient stupidity. You know, this smart guy all the way along, and all of a sudden, he doesn't look over in the back of his car when he gets in. And there's the, you know, there's the many tentacle thing waiting for him. You know, that's just cheating. And it's lazy also. So yeah, emotionally consistent as well as narratively consistent. Mm-hmm. And creatively consistent.
Yeah.
And I think within that, if you set it up right, people will forgive you a lot of stuff. But if you're cheating, they don't. They go, oh man, I thought this person had something. Damn it. Yeah.
Well, and if you're, you know, planning on doing travel retreats and inspiring people to go to these places, you do want to have there be some, you know, enough cohesion and connection that.
And authenticity, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you can have that that word without being, you know, didactically factual.
Yeah.
Right.
So. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's my goodness, so much good stuff. Anyone have any final questions?
Aaron, you haven't said a word, dude. You said you had questions last time.
I know.
I may have asked, or else maybe you need to go on the phone separately.
Well, right now is about nap time, so that's not helping. But like half of my questions were asked by my mom at the beginning.
Okay, good.
And kind of answered throughout.
That's a good mom. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So mostly I started, like Lissy mentioned, I don't know if was that last year, mom, beginning of last year or the year before. I don't remember. I got an idea. I think it was like middle of the night for a book series. That'd be pretty cool. Fantasy. And I just started like outlining it like crazy. Ideas for cultural things and philosophical things and creating a journey with like kind of pieces of a person, you know, but separated into different people kind of idea. And I like outlined it for a long time, and then I started world building using like an online tool. Like you make your own sort of wiki sort of thing. And that was really fun. I just like really enjoyed that. And then at a certain point we started working on our other book and I had to put that one aside. And now I have no motivation to return to this other book. Does that ever, I mean, you already talked about like sometimes you just gotta like throw books out. I mean, I'm not saying I'm there yet, but
totally undersold that outline. I was so stoked for this fantasy world when you first explained it to me.
Well, I'm not going to sit here for an hour and like show you the, it's been too long too.
That's the first time I've heard about you not wanting to go back to it. And it makes me sad.
Yeah. Well, I haven't had any motivation to go back to it. It's just how it is. So, but yeah, I mean, most of my questions would have been around world building, but it sounds like you do it as you go.
Yep.
I like to plan. Mm-hmm. I like, you know, and but even in the planning, there's those spontaneous things that happen. Yes. That I really enjoy.
Yeah, and the way you're doing it sounds like you're writing a screenplay, because that's what I had to do, is do all that pre-work, then sit down and write the screenplay based on it. I don't know. Your sister says it's cool, and I mean, you know, relatives can be really brutal critics. So maybe she's telling you the truth. Might be.
Yeah, maybe you should listen to her.
I don't know about that.
We're all pretty excited about it. It's kind of one of those amazing ideas. But maybe it's about just setting aside time and seeing if you can hang out with it again and see if it starts talking to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I throw out one other suggestion to you, man? If you're open to it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right.
You know, again, maybe for you, your constraints are a little bit the outline and you don't have the motivation. What if you maybe just thought about it a little bit, some more coffee or something, and just someplace in that story that you think would be cool to write, you know, because when you're talking about beginning something in the world building, there's all this context you got to set up, and there's this and this and this, and that's kind of some heavy lifting. Whereas if you just grabbed out, you know, your favorite scene of the character where he, you know, begins his journey, or he's at the Dark Night of the Soul or whatever, write that. And that might generate some momentum for you, because yeah, you've got an ambitious project, which would be a lot of work. I mean, you've done a lot of the work, which is going to make it easier, but why not see if you can start with the fun thing, sort of that thing that grabbed you at first, and just run with that.
That's a good idea.
Go for that emotional thing, the emotional truth, and you can get the details and supporting stuff later. But I think what people really read for, what I read for is I want to go on a journey with people I like, or at least I'm interested in and could possibly like. I no longer read books about ugly people. It used to be I'd read anything. You know, there's a guy named James Elroy. This is a guy who really needs a keeper. But he had a terrible childhood, and he wrote all about his terrible childhood, and he writes these noir novels. And I read them and I felt debased. I'm just not interested in feeling debased anymore. So you know, what you're talking about doesn't sound like it would debase somebody. And it sounds like, anyway, to me, start with that journey. Start with that journey, because that's what people really want, I think. Otherwise, they're looking for porn, just a different name.
Well, you know, something you said earlier, Griff, which speaks to me and is a really helpful reminder, and I think in the beginning I said this more often than I do now, is when it's like, oh, what kind of book is it? What kind of story is it? And I think, well, it's like the kind of book I'd want to read. Like, and staying connected to that, I think, can keep right in that flow of where this is going to go. So like, Aaron, I mean, also the first I've heard that you've thought about not going back to it, which...
Everyone's devastated, Aaron.
Apparently. Is this the kind of story that you would want to read?
Yeah.
It's your kind of thing.
Agreed.
And maybe it's just, it's a time, it's not the right time. The time will come some other time, but like, is this the kind of thing that you want to read? Is it part of you, you know? Is that what, that's what that reminds me of. The characters, the world, the whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Aaron, your mom paid me to leave this confrontation, you know, just so you know.
Okay.
Now you get it.
Well, here's the thing. I cannot do two books at once, and she's been trying to get me to write a sequel to our book, so it's one or the other. Because I tried.
Yeah,
man.
Ooh, I tried. Yeah, wow.
Right, throw mom under the bus, too.
All of my creative juice, like, I couldn't do both. It is impossible. I felt like the quality of them fell because of that, you know?
Okay. Well, you know what? Important point too is, you know, you got to work the way you work. Everybody works differently. And if that works for you, I'd say honor it. So now it's up to your mom to decide. You know, I don't know what your contract is as far as... Yeah, there might be some wiggle room there.
We're not under contract yet.
Okay.
I like that yet.
Yet, right. There's no official contract. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Teddy, how about you? What are you thinking over there? Hearing all of this with your creative process that you've been in with your books.
I just think, oh, I'm so glad I don't write novels. That's so overwhelming. I write little stories, you know, I can see the beginning and the end. And I was just, what I was thinking, it's so weird how that, I'm just now owning at 60 some years old that I'm a storyteller. And, you know, I fought with Amanda about it for a long time. I write curriculum. So I'm owning that. And the thing that I was thinking about is I'm always afraid that it's not going to show up. For example, I'm finishing up right now a story I got inspired for. 2016, called The Tale of a Tinted Window, told everybody about it. Like, it was a great idea, but I had no idea how to bring it together. No idea, you know, and a few times I would sit down because it was so inspired and I loved the title and that I had, and but it just didn't come. And so I just didn't force it. And then I woke up one morning and, you know, there, you know, it came. The inspiration for it so far, and then it stopped and I wasn't sure what to do, so I just let it go. And then I woke up a year later, woke up another morning and recently, and just, you know, it came. So there's this idea that I have that without inspiration, without divine download, without the, I don't know how to write a story. Just, you know, that's, so there's always the fear it, whatever it is not going to show up. Mm. So, yeah. And it's funny because the exercise you put us through on the other night.
Put us through. Have to point that out.
You hear that?
Put us through. The panic. I mean, like, I didn't pick up my pen and paper for a little while because I'm like, I can't do this. I don't write on demand. I can't be creative on demand. And I mean, all these things that I guess I've been telling myself. And by the end of that, I had written myself right
into the next right identity.
Right into your next book, Teddy.
I feel you on that, that divine download train.
It was, I almost put myself under the covers or under the bed. Or I wiped myself out with my little story. But anyway, that's what I'm thinking while you guys are talking about all the structure, and I'm sitting there going, I will say a little prayer before I go to sleep, you know, when I wake up, let it be there, because I don't have it right now. I don't know what, you know. So
yeah, but I've also seen you leave one project and then move on to another, so it's still your creativity moving, it's just you're moving towards right. The thing. And you know, I think it would be really fun to look at an actual timeline of how you did this, like when you were working on it, and look at it in relationship to how they play together with the topics, because I bet there's a reason for that.
Could be
the way that you move.
Like I'm working something out.
Yeah. Like you come over here
in the story
and you expose this thing to yourself. And then you're like, oh, I learned that thing. I can come back. It frees up something else for the other project.
Right.
I would be curious about that. Cause that's kind of how I've witnessed it, but I couldn't tell you exactly how that's gone.
Just like the caterpillar with a butterfly shaped heart. I started that back in 2015, something like that. And it was just, it was enough for a children's book, one little thing, but I imagine it was not complete. It was just, it didn't take you through to the becoming the butterfly. So she just had this little dream, but it's funny how that then in like 2019, the rest of the story just kind of unfolded itself because I couldn't figure out what to do. A lot of times I wake up and I rhyme this stuff. And if the rhyming isn't there, like just let it go. And I wake up and there it goes again. And I think you're right, because now the end of that story that I wrote in 2019-20 has been what has catapulted me or pushed me or been the thing that's pushing me this year and this past year to move forward with my children's book. I wrote the book I needed to read. And I couldn't have gotten all the way through that children's book until these other things happened. I wrote the story, You and Your Invisible Magical Mattering. That set me free to write the rest of that story. Amazing. Right. Yeah, you're right. It's how that all works together.
Yeah. That's
weird.
I really feel you on the divine download stuff and not creating, like, it's like growing up, when I like birthday gifts all through high school and college, birthday gifts or holiday stuff. And people are like, oh, just write them a poem. I'm like, it doesn't work like that. I can't just sit down and create something like that's but it's like this gift that's, I've never taken ownership of it. It's just, it's a gift that was given to me type of thing. And I think what I really take away from this conversation, Griff, and the last one too, is the discipline that you've created with that gift that you've had your whole life, and you've fostered it, and you've like even just your morning routines or your morning discipline, like, yeah, I have this gift, but I don't have a discipline developed around it that would help foster it and help grow it. So
I agree with that. Like, you know, we've talked in some of the retreats about having like a ritual in the morning or something that you're kind of setting up to get yourself in that flow and that zone. But I've done some of it and sometimes I don't do it. And, you know, I just have my phone right here, like just little things that are not honoring necessarily of the part of the process where you've made a commitment, right? Like that's, I liked what you said, Griff, about like, I've made a commitment to this. So having that be your intention. So, you know, shutting the door, no phone, here's my 2-3 hours, because this is like something that my soul is trying to speak, and I'm going to sit and listen and honor it and hear what it has to say, you know, versus filtering through all the chatter. And just like the Bird by Bird book, the other book that I read around the same time as Stephen King's On Writing, which is very similar. I mean, their styles are very different, but it's a very similar book. And he calls his as Man in the Basement.
Yeah.
And who he describes as like an old man who just sits down there smoking cigars and drinking whiskey, just crotchety old man, but it's where his soul is. So if he can quiet down and like listen, the man in the basement will fill him with the ideas. It's like his version, I think, of divine download. Honoring.
Yes, absolutely. And I like that. And just kind of build on that, something that you said, Alyssa, and I think also Teddy. What came to me, and it was something Alyssa said about, you know, the divine gift, you know, it just doesn't work like that. What I thought was, but you're treating the gift like it's on loan.
Mm.
You know, Alyssa, I mean, you do have that divine gift, but you're telling yourself, well, I can't. I bet you can.
It's not on loan.
It is not on loan. And I'd say that to Teddy too. I mean, when you're talking about waiting for inspiration, I mean, I think, you know how you used to make sugar candy, the super saturated water with sugar, and you drop a single crystal, piff. That's your inspiration, is that crystal, you know? And I'm telling you guys, it's not on loan. It was a gift for you to use. You don't need permission. You don't need permission to use it.
You know, some would say, like, Amanda, I know you know this from reading my stuff, is through Native American, right? Lakota tribe in particular. They said it's not just a gift, it's an obligation. That if you have received, whether it's, you know, your future self sings to you and Alyssa's future self writes her poetry, this is a gift that you have received, but you now have an obligation to take it out into the rest of the world.
Yeah. I didn't use the word commitment lightly, because I think in a way it was that decision when I said, you know, I don't want to read debase stuff that debases people. I want to write stuff that lifts people up and nobles, because it is kind of an obligation. I mean, there's no good thing men, human beings can't debate. You know, my joke is that the first thing Gutenberg printed was a Bible. The second thing was a girly man. You know, there's no good thing we cannot make worse. So let's take a good thing and use it for good. See, you know, let that gift shine, Teddy, Alyssa, because you, Carolyn, Lori, Aaron, you guys got the gift. I mean, I'm not a big fantasy guy, weirdly, but you know, I want to hear more about Aaron's idea, and you know, and the butterfly, the caterpillar, the butterfly shaped heart. I mean, I hear that. And now you're talking about the Lakotas. Now I'm interested. I'm interested in all this stuff. And you guys have, you were given this gift for a reason. You know, it wasn't like an talk about obligations. It wasn't, oh God, it's their birthday, let me give them a pet rock just so I can appear to give them something. No, you guys got gold. Let it shine, man. Spin that gold. You know, the widow's mite. You know, you were given gold. Invest it. Use it. Spread it out. Because, you know, think of the people's lives you can change with your stories, with your good stories, with your stories of like soul and heart and value. know.
I feel like we need to add preacher to your bio now.
I was just going to say, are you ready to give the altar call? Or like, who's going to give the benediction? Are we going to close with?
Testify. Yes.
Testify. That was like a nice mic drop.
That was perfect. Griff, thank you so much for hanging out with us again. We're just probably going to schedule another one in a little bit of time because it's just so much fun.
Okay.
And thank you to all of our listeners for listening to this episode of Sipso Story and Sanity. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving us a review, and maybe even sharing something that happens as a result of you adding a little discipline or shining your gold. You can also find out more details about True to Intention and Saved by Story, the new publishing company that's coming up. And that's a wrap for today. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.